bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody, that's me.
So the thing I wanted to talk about, which obviously I'm biased and we might be a little bit too, but kind of like the really awesome news from last week, and we say awesome because we had firsthand experience playing with it, is OpenAI has released an API. OpenAI is the artificial intelligence research organization that was originally founded by Elon Musk and Sam Altman with the goal of developing benevolent AI. How do you prevent Skynet? How do you make sure that AI helps us and doesn't work against us? And they've done a lot of incredible research, including we talked a while ago about GPT-2, which was this text transformer that could create entire articles. They just released GPT-3, where GPT-2 was based on like 1.5 billion parameters to program it. GPT-3 was based on 175 billion. And that's one of the technologies that goes into this API. And what the API does is you give it a bit of text, any kind of text, and it tries to figure out what comes next. And the power for this is pretty incredible. So Bryce has up on the screen here an example of something that I found when I played around with it, where if I gave it a list, I just gave it a list, send it number one, Batman, number two, Superman, number three, Cyborg. That's all I did. All I did is wrote these things down and sent it to the API. It responded with those first three, and then it added The Flash, number four, number five, Martian Manhunter, number six, Green Arrow, number seven, Hawkman. Now, what do they all have in common?
I mean, they're all DC properties, and they're all some part of... wait, they're not all in the Justice League, are they?
I think so. At least, probably like, at in terms... Point. Like, yeah, they have all... I think Cyborg, they pulled from the cartoon, but he was in the Justice League movie, so...
Yeah, so it knew that I made a list, right? I didn't say give me a list. I just gave it three items labeled one, two, and three. It figured out that they were superheroes, like you said. They figured out they were DC superheroes, and somebody pointed this out on Twitter. I didn't even realize. All dudes. Yeah. If I gave it a list of a mixed list, it will come back with, you know, different, like male and female. If I just give it female, it'll just list female superheroes. That's how smart this is. It was never trained to do this. It was never programmed to give you lists or to give you lists of superheroes. And so for fun, I went and I gave it a list of like three of my favorite science fiction books. And it responded back with eight more. Five out of eight I'd read and I loved because it found the commonality between them all.
So I went a different direction. And by the way, how much are we allowed to disclose at this point? Just
I think what you've played around with it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. So we had early access to this and, I put in, doggone it. Let me see if I can find the text thread because all I did was I typed in, Brian : welcome to Night Attack with my co-host, Justin Robert Young. Tonight we have an amazing guest. That's all I wrote. And the very first response was it just completed with, his name's Teller, and he's part of the international touring duo Penn and Teller. And then it went on to just write dialogue between Teller and Brian and Justin. It was amazing.
It is. Yeah. And when we talk about the power of this, it is beyond anything that I've ever seen in terms of artificial intelligence, mostly because you don't have to put a lot in. Again, like Brian didn't put in or train it specifically on Night Attack stuff. It didn't specifically train it on who Justin was, who Brian is, what a guest does on a comedy podcast. It was literally just like, hi, my name is Brian, joined as always by my co-host Justin and our special guest. And then like what would appear to be a transcript of a Night Attack show just spits out. Like that's what's remarkable about this is how powerful that engine is and how little you need to put in to spit back amazing stuff.
Well, so here's the funny part is half the time it accurately figured out who our friends are. Like half of the results were versions where there'd be conversations between, you know, me and Tom Merritt or Rex Williams or, you know, people who have actually been on the show. And then every so often, like the third time in, it would surprise me with a name that I had never seen before. I'm like, who's this? And then I would look up that person and my first thought would be like, oh, that's somebody we should definitely book to have join us on Night Attack. So yeah. It's like the question that I have is like, with something like this, the question is less what can you do with it? It's like, how do you stop yourself from thinking of all the possibilities of all the things that you could do with it? You know, it's like how do we limit it? And if nothing else, like what I've seen right now is let's say we're a big enough organization that we need somebody to book guests for Weird Things and Cord Killers and After Things or whatever. Like this AI, you just keep hitting refresh and it will give you suggestions, almost all of which will be valid in this space. Like today we brought in an expert on cord cutting and how to watch what you want, when you want, on whatever device you please. His name is, and then just let it finish. And I'm going to bet like that's a whole job that is now pretty much done.
It's insane. And so it's basically what they call one shot, meaning like, it just gives you, you give it one example and it creates, you know, its data from that. And that's what's so spooky is you just gave it your podcast, you know, intro, and somewhere in the data that went into it, it probably consumed a lot of podcast transcripts, including your own, which helped it do that. And I've started playing around with it and building all sorts of apps. So if you go to aichannels.app, you can see some of the things that I made with this. At the very bottom, I made a bunch of different, I have a list, you know, there's the app there. And so, cause it's just, you just start playing around with all the possibilities of what you can do with this. And it's incredible. And, you know, I started learning all the little kind of insights and tricks on how to get better responses and was making chat bots where you could talk to like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells or writer roundtables with Neil Gaiman and Stephen King.
What one of the suggestions I made is Twitter is one of those things that happens to be an open fire hose that nobody bothers to think of as that. So you can actually talk to yourself from 10 years ago. Like feed it, feed it what you were saying and thinking in 2011, and then you can introduce yourself to yourself and have a conversation.
Yep. Yeah. It's insane. I thought as a demo here, I made for, some of the stuff I've been making, some of my documentation OpenAI is now using to sort of explain it. And one of the things I did is I made a demo of how to build a chatbot, and I made a sarcastic chatbot. And I thought maybe if you guys want to ask Marv questions, we could see his responses.
Sure.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Marv, what, the AI specialist?
Yeah, just Marvin
Minsky.
Yeah, or Marvin the robot from
Marvin the Martian. Okay. All right. Whatever. all right. Here, are we live? Can I ask?
Yeah. Yeah.
Ask. Yo, what's up?
He writes, "Ha, Marv 2.0."
Okay. All right. Ask him what makes you better now?
Boring answer. A beta version has been deployed with a brand new knowledge base.
Classic Marvin.
Ask him like a real question, not about him, but ask him
how's the weather been?
Who's
lately?
The best Avenger?
Who is the best Avenger? That is a good question. That is a question whose answer is not obvious, which is a nice word for hard to answer. I'll ask him again, see what else he says.
I mean, I don't even know why I'm missing Comic-Con, since this is half the answers I'm going to get.
I ask him again. Every time you ask him, he gives different answers. So I asked him that again. You know the Captain America theme song? Just start singing that over and over, and nobody will notice I don't have an answer for you.
What's the most populous state in the union?
Marv, look at your hands. Now look at the keyboard. Now look back at your hands. Now back at the keyboard. type in Google if you need more help.
That's amazing.
I created Marv with just 8 lines. I gave a transcript of him sarcastically answering questions, and he learned from that.
And just to be clear, so what did not happen? These are not pulling answers from a database that you particularly put in or trained it on. Like you put in very, very little to direct it to be a sarcastic robot, and that one liner was not a part of it.
Exactly. That is entirely generated here. If I keep asking him over and over again, all of these sarcastic responses are spontaneously generated.
So let me feed in what I did for Night Attack, and I'll give a few spontaneous responses here. So what I'm entering is, hello and welcome to Night Attack. I'm Brian Brushwood here with my co-host, Justin Robert Young. We have a very special guest today. I'll just keep hitting refresh and you can see what we come up with. Submit first response is Steve clapping. Thank you, Steve. And oh no, wait, there you go. How are you doing, Steve? I guess we got to grab Steve.
Yeah, let's get Steve on this.
Okay, so let's try again. All right, here we go. We'd like to welcome Robert Leroy Johnson whispers. Wow, that was weird. You may know him as the president of Sony Online Entertainment. But today he's here to tell us about EverQuest. Shockingly close. All right, here, let me
Robert
try it again.
Robert Leroy Johnson is a blues guitarist from...
Yeah, of course. Well, he sold his soul to the devil, so, you know.
Let me see what completes this time.
Do you have the word podcast in that prompt?
Welcome to Night Attack. I'll go ahead and add that to the Night Attack podcast.
I'm not sure if you did this in your first go-round, but just having the formatting of, like, Brian colon that, and then like because I think that also indicates, like, again, it does not take much for this to pick up and understand formatting, which is something that's like really, really, really powerful and remarkable about
okay
it.
So the only thing I'm changing is I'm putting everything I said in quotes, and I'm setting it up as line one of a text dialogue. So it says, Brian, hello and welcome to the Night Attack podcast. I'm Brian Brushwood here with my co-host Justin Robert Young, and we have a very special guest today. And the response is, and by the way, we should borrow this, he's big and he's blue and he's totally not Hercules. I'll put a second line in here, Justin, quote, I can't wait. We have a very special guest today, Justin, I can't wait. Dr. Chris Ryan comes out. Brian and Justin do the ritual handshake. In reference to the
so now it's giving stage direction. Correct. for what happens. So now Chris Ryan has come out, and me and Brian do a ritual handshake,
and then it explains in reference to the fist fighter video they just watched earlier. Dr. Chris Ryan, quote, I think this goes on, Brian, for 10 hours, right? So it's a very elaborate handshake we're doing. Dr. Chris Ryan. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. He goes on for, like, I don't know, maybe 7 hours. Brian. So I guess this means you're doing Night Attack. Is that true? Dr. Chris Ryan, yes, I was in the lab all night, like, doing these radio measurements. I can't. Justin, you've got access to the keys to the kingdom, because, by the way, I'm pretty sure what we're doing is pre-show for tomorrow's Night Attack. It's going to be amazing. I want to put together the BitBot where we feed it all of the previous bits that we've done, and then just with a straight face we have to just go off script.
I mean, look, I have played around a lot with the stuff that Andrew's built with the AI channel stuff, and, like, that is remarkable. There was a a couple times where you can chat with authors. And there was one line that was like just amazing. So it's like you're chatting with Neil Gaiman, and I don't want to get it wrong, Andrew, and I know you know it offhand, but idea of like suspense.
How do you write science fiction and fantasy?
A science fiction and fantasy, and it was like it was as if you were imagine if you went to Stockholm and got mugged by Darth Vader.
Just a very Neil Gaiman thing to say.
Yeah,
according
to the script, Night Attack begins with us saying, introducing a man who's just wonderful, an angel of a man. You know him, you love him, the angry video game nerd. Which this to me was the most interesting part, was the parts that it didn't accurately figure out were people that we had already dealt with. All of a sudden, I'm just like these are great suggestions. Oh, wait. You know him, you love him, Scott Sigler. Scott, hi, guys. Let's see. You know him, you love him. It's like Groundhog Day. Trace Dominguez, who we know from Revision 3, Discovery Digital. Wow. Hold on. I just want to keep on going this way. I'll tell you if I have another good one.
Well, while we do that, we will remind you that this show happens because of your largesse at patreon.com/weirdthings. Again, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can kick in some money for this show. You also get a custom RSS feed that makes sure that you get the podcast as soon as it is posted anywhere, direct to the podcatcher of your choice. Help keep this show alive. patreon.com/weirdthings.
By the way, while you were doing that, Will Wheaton appeared on Night Attack, and we wanted to do a big, fun, funny thing, but we had to talk about a charity first, which all of that sounds right on the nose.
Well again, and that's the crazy thing here isn't that random stuff comes out. The crazy thing here is how much, with as little as is being put in, how realistic it is getting it on the first and second go round. You know, there's a lot of things that can pump out a lot of random stuff, but like, I just have to say the power here is remarkable. I was talking to a friend of mine who works at a tech news site that will remain nameless. But he was talking about how within their circles of editors, they've talked about how much more prevalent AI generated content is. And boy, I gotta say, if you type in the lead, if you can write a lead to a story, I feel like you might have a vast majority of it, or at least background on it with something like this.
By the way, I've been hitting refresh, and so far we've had Jason Murphy show up, but most importantly, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Night Attack. I'm Brian Brushwood here with Justin Robert Young. We have a very special guest, Justin. I can't wait. Brian, introducing a man who's just a wonderful and just an angel of a man. You know him, you love him. It's R.L. Stein. Justin.
Wow.
Justin, quote, oh my God, squeals. R.L. Stein, thank you very much. It's a thrill to be here. Justin, what's your first question? It's just an awesome beast move to make to a guest.
But also look at that. Look at R.L. Stein is a bit on our show.
Right.
Right. And this thing was able to get it on so little input.
It's too on the nose.
I mean, if it sounds random and you have not heard Night Attack, then understand that is the product that it is mimicking.
Oh. Look, I wish I could look you in the straight face and say I'm not going to keep hitting refresh on this and finding out what else it suggests.
Let's see if we can get through the rest of the show.
The hero of the free world, Ken Jennings.
Aphantasia, you guys heard about this?
This is the thing for some where people. You can't visualize spaces, right? And instead you reduce them to kind of text descriptions in your mind.
People who have no internal visualization ability. So if you say, imagine a bicycle in your head, many of us can imagine a bicycle inside our head, but some people can't. They say they have no concept of a mental map or mental image of that.
Yeah.
So you can't, there's no internal visualization.
Yeah. And I did a little survey on Twitter to ask what percentage of people, you know, said that they weren't able to visualize stuff internally. And again, it's Twitter survey, but I had 8% of people said no. And some of people were like, that seems crazy to me that you can do that. And I started looking it up and found some other articles about it. I think Penn says he has that, of Penn and Teller.
Yeah, yeah. He's mentioned that on his podcast.
Which makes you wonder, like, what other things do we take for granted for the way that we process information or we see things or whatever that aren't universal?
Yeah. The man, there are so many directions to take this. I'm reluctant to overgeneralize or whatever, but on a personal level, I know that that I have a tendency to be very, very focused on whatever's in front of me. And I tend to be very, very bad at just sort of hearing something, logging it, and keeping it in the back of my mind. And only recently did we figure out that my mother-in-law would oftentimes say, hey, doesn't have to be right now, just so you know, that trash has to go out. And I would immediately jump up and go and grab the trash and take it out. And to her, it was early on perceived as an affront, like, hey man, I said it doesn't have to be a thing right now. But she, what we have since learned over the last, you know, 15, 20 years is I can't handle it. Either exists right now or not at all for me. Right. Some might call it a deficit of attention. Others might call it a disorder. But it was weird to realize, like I never intended to be rude. All I knew is, like, there's a thing, and I know for a fact that if I intend to do it later, it'll never get done. So I would just do it right now. But of course, wasn't perceived that way by the person who is bringing it up.
I'm very confused by that. I think I get it though.
What I'm saying is I'm literally diagnosed with ADD, and it took us 15 years to realize that I wasn't being rude to my mother-in-law by immediately jumping up and taking out the trash the moment she mentioned it. And instead, it was quite literally it was the only way for me to honor her request, was because I knew for a fact if I didn't do it right then in that moment, it was never going to get done, because I quite simply lacked the ability to hold on to a random to-do floating in the ether for more than 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting, because I used to always postpone stuff, and I probably had, when I was younger, would have been diagnosed as ADD. But I do tend to try to get the thing done now, because, like, oh, can you do this? I'm like, I look in my head, like, can I get it into the next 5 minutes or 10 minutes? And I'm like, I'll just do it now, because, like, I don't want to worry about it later. I don't want to have that, you know, just that post-it note stuck on my brain.
Yeah, and maybe that's the realization I've had over the last 4 or 5 years, is that it's less of a don't want to, because I've always understood not wanting to have anything hang over your head. But once you wrap your mind around the idea that maybe the word is not don't, but can't, like, I literally can't hold on to it. It won't happen, and I'll dishonor this person when tomorrow morning the trash is still not taken out, you know. And yet I can totally see that somebody saying, hey, not now, but whenever you get around to it, do a thing. And that person immediately leaps up from the couch, runs over and does the thing, how that would feel insulting, because you wanted to give them time, but not understanding that that other person, like, literally lacks the ability to keep this in a holding queue to get around to later.
That's a weird, yeah, that is a weird social situation, because, like, the person, you know, your mother-in-law was, like, offended because she felt that her generosity was being viewed as a marching order when she specifically took the verbal steps to make sure that that's not how it came out.
Right. But, and then meanwhile, my actions are in line with me acting like, message received, general, and then immediately, but really, yeah. From my perspective, what I was trying to do was honor her by saying, I know it either gets done right this minute or it will never get done. So let me honor you by hopping up and immediately doing it at this moment.
So Tally Zarell in the chat room was saying that aphantasia is something that's recent. Like it is not something that has been super well studied, I guess, for decades and decades.
I believe that. And I think that's why I brought up the question of like, what else is there? Because it is such a new thing to sort of discuss. You know, there was a lot of research years ago with, let's say, people who had epilepsy or stroke victims, or people had sort of like the hemispheres of their brain separated and stuff. And we noticed there were very much differences in the way people process stuff. And now we're starting to take for granted that everybody's internal way is the same. And the thing that I'll say, this is anecdotal, but I've known of the people I've known personally that I've known that had aphantasia, they are all extremely artistic. Two of them were jugglers, one of which was a person that made intricate puzzle boxes. And I'd ask him, like, how do you design this if you can't see this thing in your head? And he's like, and it was hard for him to articulate, but he would draw things out on paper, for one. But it was a very fascinating sort of thing. I think for him, maybe he did a lot of it on paper, but it was just hard for me to I just couldn't even process that. Cause like when I imagine a magic illusion, I would see the thing in my head, I'd visualize it and try to imagine this. But here's a guy that was making intricate, really clever things that didn't have that mental model.
This is interesting. So from the Wikipedia page on aphantasia, Ed Catmull, co-founder of Pixar and former president of Walt Disney, is somebody who has this, but also surveyed 540 colleagues from Pixar about their mental visualization and found that production managers tended to have stronger visualizations than the artists.
There was a conversation last night where I was trying to describe the experience of what it's like shortly before a production shoot starts. And the way I described it is, I'm being on tour. You're probably familiar with this, Andrew. Like, you're on stage, you're doing the magic show, but your brain has kind of two angles going. One is running the functions of the magic show, saying all the jokes or whatever. But the other part is scanning the audience, figuring out who laughed harder at which joke, who's going to be good three routines from now to pick up as a volunteer, that kind of thing. In production, I've discovered that feeling, that sensation, is number one, amplified, but also harder split. And it's sort of I was trying to explain to one of the team why I'm not very approachable in the hour to half hour before a shoot. And the way I explained it is because my brain is broken into two coils that are tightening up, getting ready. One of which is trying to predict the future of everything future me is going to hate about everything we make, everything that is going to need to be cut, and how it, by virtue of time traveling to this moment, I can figure out how to avoid in advance. The other half is the extrovert performer who's coiled up and is making up in his mind the applause of the crowd that is not there right before going. And then finally, it's like, you know, we're there, the cameras are rolling, and you know, of course, both sides try to unspring and uncoil and do the best that they can. But there's something about the duality of, you know, like objectively what you have to do is show up, say the words, do the thing does the thing or whatever. But that's not all that's going on. There's the completely separate other side of the anticipating what future you is going to have to deal with and trying to solve problems as if you're pre-time traveling into the moment that of shooting. Does that track? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I just say I have a lot on my mind.
Okay. I mean, I suppose I'm as fascinated as anybody as like what is happening and why am I being this way? But those were the words that I happen to have for it the other night.
Yeah, I think that, you know, to touch earlier when you talked about doing the show, if it's new and I'm still working out the bits, I won't be able to focus on the audience and stuff. I'll be thinking about just, you know, the sleight of hand and that. Once I get comfortable with that, that's muscle memory and my brain can do without thinking, then I can start thinking about like, oh, you know, what's going on in the audience. And, you know, one of my favorite examples is David Copperfield has this microphone in a line where he can talk to his backstage crew while he's on stage. And he's so rehearsed at what he does. When his back is to the audience, as he's moving a prop, he can be giving them instructions and stuff. And I've heard, and have no proof of this, that it's actually connected to a cell phone. And if he needs to make a call when he's on stage, he can do that.
I also have no knowledge of this, but I know a friend of mine happened to have a front row seat to a show when he was in Texas and told me before I had heard anything else, like that dude was definitely having casual phone conversations in the middle of his act. That's what somebody who is not me said.
Yeah. Well, that just, you know, when you've been doing it long enough and you know all the beats, and that's why you look at like what makes like great performers. You look at like, you know, Freddie Mercury or an Elton John, the music, they're not worried about playing the music because that was just going to come. They're not like, oh, which note do I hit or what key do I press? They already knew. Now they're like, I'm going to have fun with the audience. I'm going to enjoy all these other moments in between because, you know, and that's when you're just watching it. What, you know, a great showman or showwoman is they just know their stuff so well that they can add another layer to it.
So have any of us heard a version, a representation of Aphantasia that makes it clear to us? Because for me, it's like I can hear the words. I'm not able to visualize things. And the closest I can think of is one of the most challenging things I've ever done was the dance competition reality show that I did, where, you know, kinesthetic movement does not come naturally to me. So instead, what I would have to do is listen to the music and I would be taught the moves and then I would come up with a label for those moves. Like, oh, this is shimmy, shimmy, shake or whatever, or this is sad panda or whatever. And then in my mind, I would run as the music ran. I would run what to my imagination looked like a rock band style or Guitar Hero style list of words. Like, now it's time for this one. Now it's time for that one. And it was only after I knew the words for it that I could do the thing. And I don't think that's the same as Aphantasia, but that's the closest I can imagine to it.
I mean, I'm one of these people, like, I have zero musical skill. And when it comes to choreography, I am incredibly hard to teach. And I think that other talk about like, yeah, their kinesthetic capabilities and et cetera. I think that's, you know, it might be that maybe, I mean, so you wonder, like, do they have zero internal ability to visualize, or is it just so reduced that they don't notice it?
Well,
and the same with other movements.
Here's what I know is watching my choreographer on that show, she'd be like, okay, so first it's ba 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 di ba di ba do ba do, then it's di ba cha ba chi ba wu fi fa fla fla flu, then it's ba ba di chi ba wu hui hua fi bi da, and I'm watching that and I'm seeing, I mean, obviously I understand how human bones move, but then by the time it was over, I was like, okay, can we make up labels for all of those? And you're like, well, sure. I mean, I just think of it as ba 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 bi da ba, then do ba do, then ji ba ba ji ba ja ba ji ba pa fa chu. And I'm like, okay, great. So you have the organ grinder monkey followed by the angry Republican followed by the whoops, where are my keys? That's what I'm going to call those. Yeah. So I at least know what we're going to do at any point in this music.
Yeah, I did do a show in Japan and they had to bring in an extra choreographer because like I didn't even have rhythm, right? And so like, you know, step two. And I'm like, you know, just like, you know, Hans the talking horse or whatever, like clopping my foot on the ground because I don't know what to do. And you know, the less self-conscious I was of it, the better. But I had to unlearn some things and learn other things because some people are just naturals at that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, music too. Like I can't remember lyrics to songs.
What? But those are words.
I don't remember. I have an incredibly shoddy memory. I have like very, very poor autobiographical memory, and I am very, very bad at like, I can, like, I learn tricks to learn scripts and stuff, and then I learn how to remember like tons of stuff, but I had to learn sort of like a method to do one thing than the other, but it was not a natural thing to me. You know, anything that I have that's like a memory thing was a skill that I had to develop later on and not something that came natural. But that was like, I remember first started doing acting. I'm like, I don't remember anything. Like I tell you the gist of it, tell you the point, the character, all this sort of stuff. But then it really frustrated me. And then one day I sat down and I learned basically kind of how to remember something kind of essential in a sense. And once I did that, I was great. And people came to me like, how do you remember it? I'm like, well, I start off by having a really bad memory and then figure a workaround. And then now you can have a good memory. You know, there are people that hear a song once. Like, I can't even understand the lyrics. And they're like, they hear it once. It's like, oh, I love this song. Like, I don't know what it said. You guys want to do picks?
Brains are crazy. Of course. Let's do some picks.
Hey man, this morning I watched Casablanca. I know it's a controversial pick and nobody loves it and nobody's heard of it. Small indie film. It's called Casablanca, all the way from 1942, nearly 100 years old. I mean, what could be good about that? Turns out it's not only great, it's the best Star Wars movie I've ever seen. And I say the Star Wars thing, and first of all, with the proviso of, in my heart of hearts, I am convinced that I am somehow accidentally ripping off this thought from somebody else. But what you have is you have Mos Eisley in the form of Casablanca, which is a multicultural mix of people on the very fringes of the power authority of the empire. Whoops, I mean the Third Reich. With people who are, it is a gateway for people who are on their way out of that power structure into lands of more libertarian freedom. And you have a complicated love triangle with in 1942, what I assume were fairly racy jokes about casual references to an open marriage and so on. It's remarkable. Like they paint it red that Humphrey Bogart is easily 10 years older than Ingrid Bergman. It's great. I didn't expect to love it as much as I did. It's quite good, and it deserves all of the reputation that it has.
I have a podcast pick. There is a podcast called You Must Remember This. It usually is about Hollywood history that kind of deals with more kind of like studio system, golden age, like through the 30s and 40s. It's well done. I like it. There are quibbles I have here and again, but the season that they're doing now, I think, is something fairly remarkable. It is all about Polly Platt. Polly Platt was a collaborator of and wife, a mother to the children of Peter Bogdanovich, who directed, he was a very influential director through the 70s. But she had an unpublished memoir. And so what the podcast is doing is taking the stories from her unpublished memoir, narrating it like a podcast, interviewing a lot of the relevant people that are still alive to do it. But otherwise, Polly is now no longer with us, but her voice certainly is in this podcast as her like unpublished memoir is produced. I think it's a fascinating way to go about it. And the story is remarkable, from a woman in the late 50s, early 60s to the birth of kind of a post studio dominated director auteur led Hollywood that she finds herself at the forefront at.
Also, until this morning, I did not know that You Must Remember This was a direct reference to Casablanca, TIL.
And Bogdanovich was mentored a lot by Orson Welles. So it is a kind of an interesting, you know, sort of insight into that whole world.
Oh, that is heavily, heavily discussed. Yeah. They moved to Hollywood, are obsessed with Hollywood history, and then realize all of their friends are old directors. Like, they don't have any friends their age because they hang out with Orson Welles and John Ford and Fritz Lang and like all these like icons that they are so reverent of. But things take a turn. I was not familiar with Peter Bogdanovich or Polly Platt. And there is things that if you are aware of Hollywood history, you might know that are kind of that were explained to me for the first time. But it's well worth doing.
I got a pick. I just finished re-binge watching this. It's relatively quick because there's only 10 episode seasons out. But I just rewatched Succession on HBO. It's really interesting watching it the second time. The first time I watched it, when the second season was airing, I felt like, oh man, this is like kind of a goofy sort of drama, but still like a drama. And now watching it the second time, kind of knowing where the twists and turns are, seeing it as like a seeing all the comedy elements in there, not just like as a parody of The Rich, but also just like actual I don't know, bits and gags. I think it's really solid. Succession.
You know, the thing about Succession, and I was trying to think of like why I like Succession and what turned me off to The Crown, because I think both are dealing with characters in such heightened state of privilege that their lives are both realistic in that they are humans with human desires, but unrealistic in what they are worrying about versus what the average person is worrying about. And the balance that Succession is able to hit in a way that The Crown for me was not, is that I care about these characters. And I think the show cares about these characters as flawed as they are. And they're not always asking you to make a value judgment or even leaving the door open for you to make a value judgment that makes you that got in the way of me wondering whether or not they're going to accomplish their goals or fall short in this particular episode, which, you know, I think is very, very, very hard to do when you're talking like it's a show that dives right into the teeth of what a family that is basically the Murdochs meet a Disney or Universal Corporation, you know, what they are doing. They do not steer away from the political stuff, but I think it's well done. I like it.
Yeah. Andrew, what do you got?
I watched this last night and I was thinking, and probably the last time I saw it was when it was in theaters, and it wasn't a great movie, but it was a little bit fun. And watching it now and just looking at the production design, I'm talking about the Flintstones movie. And
wow.
I don't know if you would
the one with John Goodman.
Yep. And if you go back and you watch it, you realize they did some amazing stuff. And now I know a lot more about, like, you know, where locations are and stuff. They built like their neighborhood in Bedrock out in the Vasquez Rocks, which are the sort of those famous rock formations you see in Star Trek movies at that odd angle. Sure. Like, they literally built Bedrock out there. And, you know, they shot like this big rock quarry. If you go back and you just look at the details that went into it, it's really a really amazing achievement how well they're able to sort of create that cartoon like world with that. And I was just watching it for that part alone. I was pretty impressed by, you know, the story is, yeah, you know, but that was enjoyable. But I just, the production design alone, I just go, man, this is, I can't think of a movie that's had this incredible kind of production design that detailed. So it's worth it.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. 94, and even just thinking about the thinking about the Flintstones movie, like it was really, really that design just looked like amazing. And like it and on a way that I don't think I don't know if we'll ever kind of really even see it again, because of like, they just had to do everything physically. I feel like we would see so much more, even, you know, smart CGI to make it look good. But like, it's pretty crazy.
They would do like Dino was CG. There were some CG elements into it, but what they did practically was really what gave it so much charm. You know, like the vehicles going by and like the buses and people's feet below it, you know, pushing them along was cool. And all the jokes like they had like Rock Donald's, you know, and somebody's putting a new plaque that says over 12 served.
Yeah.
So again, a cute movie. I think it's fun to go back and sort of watch just the production design alone. I thought was great. And there's sort of the backstory was that Spielberg was produced by Amblin. And when John Goodman was at like a table read for Always, Spielberg like stood up and said, "I found my Fred Flintstone. It's John Goodman." And they asked John Goodman, like, "How do you feel about it?" He's like, "Well, it wasn't really a role I sought after, but it was kind of like, you know, kind of boxed in on it." You know, once Spielberg said this,
there was a Wired article where, like, by the numbers per IMDb, they calculated that by the numbers, there is no greater supporting actor than John Goodman. Like him as supporting role equals the maximum return on investment compared to him as lead character, Flintstones, King Ralph, or whatever, not so much.
But I'll tell you what,
Flintstones actually did really well financially. Flintstones actually did it was
sure. But $40 million. This is also factoring in like, you know, critical acclaim and that.
Sure.
Stuff.
Well, you know, and I'll tell you what, for John Goodman, I mean, when that moment is happening, that's likely. I mean, Flintstones comes out in 1994, so it's probably around 1992 or 1993. But that is like after Steven Spielberg has shot or has released Jurassic Park. Like, you know, there's no more powerful entity, you know, than Steven Spielberg in 1993.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.